Hello and welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. Our mission here is to offer hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. What follows is the audio from selected videos posted on Recovering from Religion's YouTube channel. So sit back, relax, and enjoy.
We have some amazing guests today. So we have Praya Westervand Otero, who is LMHCCASAC, and she's a mental health professional specializing in individual relationship, alcohol and substance abuse, and sex therapy with an emphasis on alternative relationships. So welcome, Praya. We also have Rebecca Williams, who is LMFT. She is a marriage and family therapist specializing in preserving marriages and in family relationships with people with religion. And finally, we have Casey Hodos. I hope that's how you pronounce it. LCMHC, and she's a mental health professional specializing in the adjustment to motherhood, including postpartum depression, anxiety, as well as loss and grief. So welcome, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's really good to see you all again. We've had you on individually, giving some very topic-specific discussions, but it's really nice to kind of bring you all together here to combine your knowledge of the various fields and get some questions answered for some folks. I think this was actually your guys' idea to have this, wasn't it?
Was. Okay. Guilty.
This was a great idea. Great, great idea. Well, why don't we go ahead and get started right off the bat. We've got some questions via email that was kind of like the very basic about therapy. And the question is kind of like, is therapy just for crazy people?
So I'll be answering that one right there. Hello. My name is Praya. My pronouns are she, her, hers. So I get this question a lot, especially with people that are brand new to therapy. They don't really have much experience with it. They're not entirely sure who would benefit from it or why or how or any of this stuff. So I like to give in my initial sessions a brief kind of explanation of what therapy is, and then we discuss. So when it comes to therapy, it is absolutely not just for crazy people. That is a big fat no. I like to tell everyone that absolutely every person would benefit from therapy. I, as a therapist, have been in therapy. So I tell regularly every single person can benefit from therapy at one point or another in their life. Some people would benefit from it as a long-term recommendation. Some people only require it for a short term because they're having some difficulty managing something going on in their life, and then they finish therapy and that's it. But for me, it's worldwide. Like, everybody could benefit from it at some point or another. Mostly because a therapist is there to listen, to support, guide, and provide empathy. So I think everyone would benefit from that at some point or another. This often leads to, what does a therapy session look like? I've had this question before of, is it just like venting to somebody who sits in a chair and goes, for like an hour? No. Well, it's like yes and no. I do encourage my clients to vent, to get stuff off their chest, to just get it all out there. I also let them know that at some point I will ask permission to give them feedback. And I generally will let them know, like, once you're done, I will ask you, are you ready for feedback now? And they generally say yes. I don't think I've ever had anybody say no, which is nice. But they'll generally be like, yeah, go ahead. And we'll kind of pick through everything that was said, and we'll kind of go through it. All right, what about this piece? And what about here? And you mentioned something interesting here. And then we'll kind of process it together. So it is a little bit of a venting session, but I do make it known that it's not just an hour of you and then you get up and leave. Like, we will be working together to kind of go through what it was that you said in the session.
You're not necessarily just giving advice or anything like
Oh no. Oh, I love that one. I get that a lot. We do not give advice. Do not go to a therapist for advice. We will not do any of that. Normally,
I could pay my best friend down the road half of what I would pay a therapist, and I get advice from them. But his is based off of nothing, you know. But from what I understand, especially therapists in the Secular Therapy Project, it's evidence based. And there's specific techniques to be worked through as well.
Oh yes. So like I said, in the sessions, like let's say you come in, you would tell me, "Oh, I'm struggling with X event in my life." If you tell me, what would you do in this situation? I'm going to, "Oh, no. That's not what we're doing here." And I would kind of explain that we would together analyze the situation, kind of pick it apart a little bit, and maybe figure out what would be the best road for you to take without me particularly being the one like, "Oh, you should probably do that." That's not what I do. We would together decide, okay, well, what's the pros and cons of road A, B, or C? Which one do you feel most comfortable going down? What are the consequences you may face as a result of it? Are you cool with that? And then we can kind of figure out what's the next step if you do decide to go down that road or not. But I am not there to tell you, "Oh yeah, that one's the best option for you." Mm-mm.
It's great that we're talking about this, because I think that there is this stigma that if you go to therapy it's because there is something wrong with you, and you must be crazy, or you know, you must have like a very in-depth issue that needs a professional to solve it in a way, when in reality is something that I think we should all try at least once, and that anyone can benefit from.
Oh yeah, absolutely, because for some people, the therapist is the first and sometimes even the only person they have in their life that's going to sit down, listen to them with no judgment, no advice, no, you know, me putting my own beliefs on them. Like, for many people, this is the only opportunity they're going to have for that. So it's a very valuable tool. And you don't have to go to therapy because you have a ginormous problem that you cannot get a handle on. I've had many people that they come to me because they're struggling with certain feelings or certain thoughts or changes in their life that they're a little bit confused about, and they just kind of want to maybe bounce some ideas off of somebody that isn't a loved one, because oftentimes the only people they have around them is a loved one, and maybe they don't want to have this discussion with them. So they do like the idea of having someone that's completely separate to kind of see from another point of view.
There's also a lot of religious leaders that will counsel folks. I know that my parents, or maybe I shouldn't say, yeah, I'll say this. My parents were, when I was young, they went, instead of to a marriage therapist, they went to their local, the pastor, and sat down and talked with them. I would imagine, like, I'm a little biased here, but I would imagine that's way different.
Yes.
What's different about that?
Sometimes skill is different. Uh-huh. Like, there is a thing called pastoral counseling, and those people get some counseling skills. And there are some pastors who are also trained, licensed mental health professionals, and I don't want to discount that. And at the same time, I think you really have to look at a person who is in that place where they're both a church leader and a mental health person. Like, they're walking a real fine line, I think, and you have to decide what is first. Oh. Right? Because you may go to one of those church people expecting that you're getting mental health advice, right? That you're getting mental health help and support, and what you're really getting is religious teaching. And if that's not what you want, that's not a good fit for you. They're not the same.
Got it.
Even though there are people who try to walk that line, they're not the same.
So this would kind of lead into the question of how would I find a therapist that would write for me? What would it look like to find a good fit, if that's the right word?
I think good fit is a perfect word. And first off, before I say how to do it, I think that it really is important that you find someone that you feel you can connect with, that you feel understands you have hope that they are competent to help with the kind of problems that you're facing, that you have some hope and trust in that person. And there's research into the effectiveness of various kinds of therapy and even comparing different therapy approaches to each other. And every like research study that I've looked at in those like comparison realms say that the connection, the relationship between the therapist and the client is the most important, even above the technique or approach.
Okay.
Like that's what makes therapy work first and foremost. And you can have a super skilled therapist, but if you don't feel connected to them, the therapy is not going to work for you because you won't feel like you can open up. You don't feel like they get you, that you can trust them, that they really are that open, empathic, non-judgmental person that Priya was talking about. So like, yes, fit is totally important. And so as you're looking for the right therapist for you, I think that's something that really matters.
It took me a long time before I actually even heard the concept, oh, you can shop around, or you can actually, you don't have to stick with the same therapist. Because I was just, when I was young, I was just kind of like, well, this is who my parents went to. This is who my parents said I should go to. And so I guess I don't know anybody else. But it took me a while to understand that this isn't working. I need to find somebody else for me.
So yeah, as far as like finding a person, Google is a wonderful tool. Look for therapists near you. The Secular Therapy Project is a great place to start because some of that vetting has already been done for you in terms of knowing that your therapist is, competent and using evidence-based approaches and runs a secular practice. Like that's a great place to start. And then you're going to look at the, like, message some of them, look at their website, see who you feel hopeful and connected to. And you can like call people. I know lots of therapists will do free phone consultations. So get on the phone with a person for 10 or 15 minutes and just pay attention to like, what does it feel like when I talk to this person? Do I feel shut down? Do I feel like, oh, I could keep talking. I said more than I meant to. Oh, that's a great sign that this is a person that will be easy for you to talk to.
I never considered that, just interviewing them as sort of and evaluating how I felt afterwards.
Yeah. Let me think, what else would be under finding a therapist that's a right fit? If you're looking for something really specific, you could look for a therapist who has training in that thing. Like even the three of us here, right? Like I do couples therapy and relationships. Like that's my thing. I also can do secular therapy with individuals, but if you're really looking for relationships, I would probably be a good fit for you. Assuming the personality thing works as well, right? And Casey helps with transitions to motherhood and Priya does sex therapy. So if you know, hey, this is the thing that I want to work on, you can use that in your search to help like narrow down. Is there a person who, when I read their profile or when I look at their website, they are speaking to the need that I have?
So it's not like one therapist fits all situations in, because I come from a construction background. And so this is going to be very crude, but it sounds like there could be a therapist for electrical issues. There can be a therapist for plumbing issues, or a therapist for drywall issues or something like that. So that makes a lot of sense. There's specialists out there.
Sure. And when you think about like human beings and human relationships are so complex, there is no way that any one individual is going to be 100% competent and expert in all of the possible things. Just like, if you want to go to your construction example, you got a general contractor and then you contract out special jobs for other things.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. Very cool. And if I don't like the therapist, what can someone do?
Okay. This is Rebecca with my therapist hat on. First and foremost, you could talk to your therapist.
What?
Tell them, yes. Tell them what's not working for you. And often this is like part of the healing and it might be part of the work that you have to do. So if in my regular life, I have a hard time telling people, like setting boundaries with them, telling them that I need them to change, asking for my needs to be met, that's probably going to show up in my relationship with my therapist too. that I also have a hard time in that relationship asking for my needs to be met, telling, you know, speaking up, telling someone what's not working. And the great thing about the relationship with the therapist is that they're there solely for you. And so that's what I would say first and foremost. If something about the therapy isn't working, talk to the therapist about that and give them a chance to either help you work through the thing that is hard for you or to change. Because sometimes we don't know. We're just human also. And so I might not know that something that I said just really doesn't work for you or that you would prefer a different way. I'm thinking, actually, a client that I worked with just a few months ago, maybe three sessions in, was like, do you just have like a paper? Could you give me a paper that like lists out these things? And I went, oh, yeah, I didn't realize that that's really what you were wanting from me, is like a big picture checklist of these are the skills I should be practicing.
Oh, wow.
I was like, sure, I could put that together for you. And I just like right off the top of my head listed a whole bunch of things. And at the end of the session, this person said, that was the most helpful thing. I loved when you did that. And we had this moment where I said, did you see how that happened though? It happened because you told me what you needed. Mm-hmm. And I was able to meet the need for you. I didn't know that's something that you needed. So you don't like the therapist, you don't like how it's doing, first and foremost, talk to them. And if they like, if they blow you off, if they get all defensive and make it like it's your problem, if they're not able to change to meet your needs, then you stop booking appointments with them and you find someone else.
I like that.
And in the context of quarantine, I'm sure a lot of people are struggling with their mental health. So people could wonder, do I have to wait until quarantine is over to be able to find a therapist, or can I do it now?
Well, I'll jump in here. I also wanted to say, I wanted to piggyback on something Rebecca was saying too about if you don't like your therapist. I think when you get started with a new therapist, it's important to not be afraid to let that therapist know if you've had a bad experience with another therapist and what didn't work for you. And most therapists will probably ask you in your first session, like, have you seen a mental health professional before? And probably will ask you a little bit about that history. And I think it's important, you know, to say like, well, I really wanted homework and my previous therapist wasn't that kind of therapist, or I felt judged by my last therapist, and, you know, provide examples maybe for the new therapist so that you start off knowing what didn't work, and your new therapist can take that into consideration when as they are trying to help you. So that's another little tip that I have. But absolutely do not wait. If you need support right now, there are so many great therapists offering telehealth. There are therapists who only do telehealth. And then there are so many right now who are offering that in lieu of in-office face-to-face appointments. And even if, you know, you think that the video, you know, a virtual session is intimidating for some reason, I would really challenge you to give it a shot, because right now that might be all that you can find. And it's really important to get the support that you need. And if you think, you know, if you really are thinking that at some point you'll want to do in-office, you know, find somebody who is offering telehealth now and eventually can see you in the office when the time, you know, when the time comes. Telehealth is accessible right now. I mean, everybody's doing it with Zoom or even like actual telehealth platforms. It's confidential. It can be done very securely. So that's not a worry. But definitely, you know, talk to your potential therapist about those concerns, and they can walk you through, you know, how to check make sure your Wi-Fi is going to work and all those things. So never shy away from asking a therapist any of these questions. You know, we're here. We want you to ask us questions, and we want to be able to support you and meet you where you are. So like I said, even if you think, well, no, I just want to wait until I can see somebody in office, I would just encourage you to get the help that you need now, you know, and worry about that when the time comes.
Yeah, it's great that you're saying that, because I think there is this like old school kind of idea that a real therapy has to be in person, that it can't be online, that if you do it online it's because there's something that's not working or that you're not going to have that connection with the other person. But there's been plenty of evidence that online therapy does work. So it's great that we have these resources in times like this.
Absolutely. And you miss, I'm sorry, Rebecca.
Go ahead.
You know, it's true. Like, you know, you are missing out on some of the body language cues and you're, it is not the same as a face-to-face visit. But it's certainly effective. And right now, you know, getting the help that you need is the most important thing. So I think that is like the priority. And if, you know, if you're worried that your therapist will go over whether or not telehealth is right for you. Certainly if you are having, you know, suicidal thoughts, there are certainly some issues that probably wouldn't be appropriate for telehealth, but your therapist can help you decide that. Sorry, Rebecca, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say, this is part of the fit issue, is that for some people, you might not be able to find a therapist who lives nearby you or whose office is close enough for you to access that has the skills to meet the problem that you're facing. And so online therapy is a great way for you to find that person who can help you if there's no one in your community that is the right fit for you. I mean, even before the pandemic, I regularly get people, even through Secular Therapy Project, who are in other parts of my state, but find me, and we do online sessions because they can't find a therapist close to them.
Yeah, that's a great point. You can search for telehealth as you, when you use STP or any of the other therapist directories, you can usually, you know, there's a setting or a, what am I thinking, a filter for therapists who offer telehealth.
Yeah, something that can just also be asked too in the initial interview type of, you know, when you're searching for it, is that right?
Yes, absolutely.
Hey, are you technologically savvy? Can you do this over the interwebs type of thing? I think that my old view of a therapist is me laying on a couch, some old stodgy guy with a notebook and a pen and a pipe, doing his Sigmund Freud crap on me. And that's just, we have gone so far from that point, I'm assuming.
Those therapists do exist, Eric.
And they definitely can't do telehealth, those therapists, right?
Right. Well, I guess like you'd have to set up your couch a certain way and have your, you know, video just right. I don't know how that works. But if that is your thing and that's what you're looking for, I'm sure you can find it.
Now, here in the U.S., we don't have any sort of socialized medicine. And so a lot of us have to go to private insurance companies or have insurance provided, health insurance provided to us through our work. I've got a lot to say about that, but that's a whole different discussion. But if I don't have insurance, if I don't have health insurance and I don't have any money, what would be some good ways to find a therapist?
Yeah, that's a huge issue, especially here in the U.S. for sure. You know, there are a lot of therapists who will offer affordable rates, or sometimes you might hear the term sliding scale, which just means that a therapist will negotiate a fee with you based on your income and your financial situation. So that is another important thing, you know, to ask when you are talking to a therapist. Sometimes on a website, a therapist website, you might have fees listed. And in the Secular Therapy Project, I believe, is there a setting there that says sliding scale or pro bono? Sure. I can't remember. Or insurance only. I can't remember what the settings are for filtering through for affordability, but
that's a good, really common these days, the sliding scale, from what I understand.
Yes. Yeah. And it really ranges. I mean, therapists do all kinds of things to help, you know, people access their services and afford things. I have three pro bono spots that I offer. And once those are full, then I have a list of therapists in my area that I refer out to that I know also do a sliding scale or affordable sessions. There's also a great resource called Open Path Collective.
Okay.
We will have the link to that in the resources. They have a directory there, and they do ask for a one-time fee that just helps them sustain the service. But you pay it one time, and then you have access to a directory of therapists that offer low-cost sessions. So you can sign up there at Open Path, openpath.org, I believe, but it's in the links. But that's another really great resource. And, you know, sometimes if you're looking for a secular therapist and you are, looking at the STP directory, and then you go to like Open Path and you look there, you can kind of cross-reference and see which therapists are listed in both places. And if you do have insurance, I mean, even with insurance, sometimes it's difficult to afford therapy. And that's a whole other ball of wax that we could get into, insurance plans and copays and such. But the important thing to know is that you do have options and there are therapists out there, and don't be afraid to ask, what is your fee, and ask, like, do you offer a sliding scale? Do you offer any other affordable rates or options, or can you help me connect with a therapist that I can't afford? It's important to just, have an open dialogue. Therapists are ready for these kinds of questions, and a good therapist wants you to get services that you need, whether it's with them or not.
And I know personally at different places that I've worked, once you're a client of theirs, if you're unable to afford the sessions, they will work with you. Like, generally it's seen as unethical for me to just drop a client because they can no longer pay. I would work with the client and negotiate something, be like, okay, let's just do pro bono for the next couple of weeks till you get back on your feet, till things get a little bit better, and then we'll negotiate again once things kind of get a little bit better for you. But I would not be in the habit of just dropping someone because of a financial situation. That's not appropriate.
Good point, Priya. Yeah. And sometimes, if you do have insurance with your employer and your employer decides to switch to a different carrier, if your therapist is now suddenly out of network, you can run into all kinds of problems, and a good therapist will work with you to help you continue your care that you need. One more thing. Sorry. I forgot about this one. Sometimes in your community, if you are looking for like a specific service related to maybe a domestic violence problem or substance abuse, there are often community services that are local to you that can connect you with therapists who can help you, and with affordable services. So don't discount that too. Maybe more scarce to find those kinds of services these days, but they do still exist. Community mental health services and things like that.
And how can we know if therapy is working? So once we have started and maybe the feeling isn't there, or you have been in a few sessions but there is no progress, how can you tell when this therapist is not right for you, or when maybe you can speak to your therapist, or you just have to change it completely?
Okay, so I can discuss that from like two points of view, as the therapist and as the client. So let me just start off with the therapist one, because that one's generally the more boring one, so we can just get that out the way first. So generally your therapist, from the beginning, during your initial sessions, will figure out a treatment plan for you, and you'll discuss what is it that brought you to therapy, what would you like to work on, and then as the weeks go on, those are the goals you'd be working towards. The therapist on their own, sometimes they do it like collaboratively, like they would work with you and be like, okay, so initially you set out this goal. How do you think we're doing on this goal? And you'd kind of like together assess, oh, I'm doing pretty good. Oh, I haven't done anything towards this yet. Or, you can do that together. So that's one way to determine how you're doing. The other way and we'll say it purely as like from the client's point of view, it's how you're feeling. So for example, if I began therapy because of anxiety issues, for example, if I'm noticing we're a month in and I'm noticing no real progress, that can be something I can start bringing up and being like, okay, I've been trying this, I've been doing this, but I don't see anything really changing. You can kind of address that with your therapist and hopefully you can come up with a plan on what's working and what's not working. There are some issues that do take a little bit longer. So that's something to also keep in mind, that not everything is going to really be visible in the first couple of weeks. There may be some things that will take a bit longer. So I generally like to have like regular touch-ins, I don't know, like little touch base kind of sessions of like, okay, we're 3 months in. How do you think we're doing? And I'll normally with my client analyze and we'll assess like, this is working, this is not working, I need more of this, I need less of this, and we'll collaboratively, we'll work together to make sure that they reach those goals that they set from the beginning.
Yeah, because I feel like if once you have started therapy with someone, it must be really hard to let go of that person, because even if you think that the therapy is not working, you have already explained probably a lot of your life to this person, you have invested money in them, time, effort, all sorts of things. So I can only imagine it must be really difficult to take the decision of just saying, I'm done, I'm gonna move on to someone new, this is not working. So yeah, thank you very much, Priya.
No problem. But I always recommend, like, sometimes as a therapist, we can kind of sense when things are not quite gelling, you know? Sometimes you can kind of tell. And I like to take the proactive stance and I'll ask, so how do you think things are going? And more often than not, I'll get a pretty decent, fully, brutally honest answer. This sucks. And I'll be like, all right, let's talk about it. Why does it suck? What sucks about it? And we'll work on it. But yeah, I've had a lot of situations that are difficult because of that, of like, wow, this person knows my entire life story. I've told them things I've never told anyone in this universe, and now I'm leaving. And it can definitely be a difficult process. Before I close a session with anybody or close like a treatment with anyone, we have those discussions of how was it? What did you learn? You know, if they're going to see another therapist, then sometimes, hopefully, in a perfect world, I would talk to the other therapist and like establish some sort of communication, but that's almost never the case. But you know, I try to make it as painless as humanly possible if I can.
Yeah. Oh. And another question that I think a lot of people can relate to is, how do you deal with family members or close friends who are maybe struggling with depression, or maybe another disorder? It doesn't have to be depression, but how do you help someone who is struggling, especially now in quarantine, where I think everyone is dealing with mental health issues a little bit more than usual?
This is hard.
Well, I know. I mean, because like we all, like I know for me, like I look at the person or like, dude, that guy needs counseling or that guy needs a therapist or, but more sincere, like almost as a joke in a sense, but more sincerely, there's people that I care about and I want to see them living their best life. I want to see them not struggling or suffering anymore. What, you know, and I love what How Am I asked it, and the emailer, like, how do we support these people?
Yeah, okay, so first thing I think is that you have to be clear with yourself about what you can do and what you can't do. Like, you all by yourself can't make your family member not depressed or not anxious. I think a lot of times our efforts at supporting people get kind of muddied up when like we have an expectation that I tried to help you, therefore you need to get better, because if you don't get better, then that means I failed at helping you. Or I need you to get better so that I feel good, which isn't actually helpful to the person who's feeling depressed. And also you can get really frustrated if you're like, I'm trying and trying and trying to help and nothing's working. And then that puts pressure on the relationship as well. So that's like the first thing, is to just be really clear about what your role is and what's within your ability to control. And then I think that you have, I mean, other therapists, feel free to chime in here on this one, but I think you have honest conversations with people about like, hey, I've noticed these things and I'm worried about you. How can I help? Or I know of this resource. Would it help you if I do a little bit of the work of vetting and just like send you a few names? If you've been in therapy yourself, you could say something along the lines of like, I found this was so helpful. Would you like me to help you find a therapist or, you know, whatever. Maybe you don't even go that far. You just say, hey, you know, when I felt like this before, therapy really helped me, and leave it at that. Probably depending on how close you are to the person and the nature of your relationship ahead of time, you would know what level of support or honesty felt right there.
Because they could get offended by someone telling them, do you need a therapist, basically.
Sure, like, right? Like, I'm not going to do that to my, you know, child's elementary school teacher or something. Like, hey, you seem to be down. Here's some names. But to one of my best friends or, you know, my spouse even, I might be a little more honest about like, hey, I think that you need help, or I think that what's going on is kind of more than we can handle on our own. Let's get you some support. But always done in a way that's just about like, I love you. I see that you're suffering and I want you to not suffer anymore.
Yeah. When you're coming from a place of concern, really genuine concern about the person because you care, I think that will come through. And like you said, Rebecca, really knowing that ultimately it's their responsibility, you know, you can certainly love somebody without putting yourself or taking their problem on as your problem. But yeah, off, you know, and asking them like, you know, you don't really seem like yourself these days. I've noticed you've been withdrawn. What do you need? Is there anything that you need from your support network?
I think especially with a person who's depressed, like asking those questions about what you need and then offering suggestions. Because in some situations, a friend might be like, yeah, I am depressed and I really just want to be alone. So please don't be offended if I turn down all of your invitations. Mm-hmm. Somebody else might be like, yeah, please keep inviting me to things and don't be mad at me if I show up and I'm kind of a grump. I'm just glad to be there. Okay, cool, right? Someone else might be like, I really don't want to go out, but could you come sit on my couch with me and we're going to watch some stupid TV? All right, fine. Right. But like, ask your friends what they want, offer some suggestions of things you could do, and then listen to what they tell you. Cause you might think that something is helpful that they actually don't experience as helpful. So be open to receiving that feedback too about what they really want.
I like that. That's awesome. What would a typical therapy session look like? Like if I was brand new into this and I stepped into an office of a professional mental health counselor, what can I expect?
Okay. I'm going to say it depends, which is a super frustrating therapist type answer.
It's true though.
Kind of nail me down and I'm not going to be specific. No, I say that it depends in large part because of who the therapist is and what kind of help you're looking for, right? Even within my own practice, a first session looks really different if I'm working with a couple than if I'm working with an individual. It's just different. There's different types of questions that I would ask you. I'm sure that, you know, amongst the three of us, given our different specialties, the things that you talk about in a first session are going to be different. But in, you know, broad general terms, you should expect to be able to talk about what's bringing you there, what you want help with. I think most therapists do some version of this in talking about what's the end goal, not just what's going wrong, but where do you want to be? If everything was fixed, what would that look like? How would we know that we arrived at your successful outcome? And sometimes when people are looking for therapy, they're really stuck in, I'm unhappy, this isn't working, everything's wrong. And even just taking some time to think about, well, what is it that I even want out of this? That question is therapeutic. So you should have some type of conversation about what the problem is and where it is that we're trying to go. And then there's just like wide variety, right? Depending on therapy style, depending on their what the presenting problem is, what type of skill you're working on. Most therapies are going to be talk-based, where we're going to talk through problems. Therapy can be like a mirror for you, like to hold it up to yourself so that you can see how you show up for other people. You can see the things the therapist like reflects back to you, the stuff about yourself that you aren't always aware of, so that we can work with those things. Sometimes they're strengths too, like, wow, did you realize that you do this thing? And this is this amazing thing that you have, or resources that you have, or whatever. So yeah, most therapies are probably talk-based. There are some therapy modalities, especially to do with dealing with trauma, that might be more body or brain-based therapies. And so those sessions might look a little bit different. What should absolutely be there is, like we talked about before, that you trust and feel comfortable with your therapist. There should be some limits around your privacy, that what's spoken in the therapy session remains confidential. The therapist isn't talking about that with other people, sharing information with your family members that you don't want shared, whatever. And for anyone in this group, what shouldn't be there is conversations about God or religion, stuff that you don't want to be there, right? I think it's really important to, I mean, this is just me as a therapist and where my own ethics are. Like, I pay close attention to what is my job in this setting and what is not my job in this setting. And I am careful about not stepping outside of that. Like, you are here to see me to work on these issues and for me to help you with these things. And we're going to stay with that. And I'm not going to move outside of putting my ideas on you or my opinions about whatever other thing is out there. I don't know if anybody else wants to chime in on that, or if we've pretty well covered what therapy sessions are like. Did I answer the question? I don't know.
Well, you know,
you did a great job.
Yeah. Generally in the first session, sometimes the first to the second, you can expect quite a bit of paperwork depending on which yes. office you're going to. So I like to tell everybody the first session is generally the most boring, because you're going to be doing a lot of paperwork and it's going to be just like interviewee and just be getting basic information about you, is just like, you know, where do you live and what do you do and all this type of stuff. Generally after that session is where we really get to the good stuff. But I always like to give that little disclaimer of that first session, not the most fascinating in the universe, you know. If you're really expecting to jump full blast in it, we may not. We may get to a little bit of it, but we may not go full blast first session. The points that I always like to kind of make people aware of what should not be in therapy, any type of judgment, any type of, like, I remember one time I went to my therapist and I was telling her all this, like, basically dating stuff. And she was like, oh, so you want to be a prostitute? And I remember just being like, this woman hasn't the faintest idea what I'm talking about. She just threw an assumption at me and I was gone after that. It was just like, whoa. I was done. And that can sometimes unfortunately happen, where sometimes you'll encounter a therapist that just either completely misreads a situation or interprets things through their own lens, and they're gonna throw it at you, and unfortunately it can cost the relationship, because it's hard to come back from that. It's not impossible, but it can be hard to come back from that, you know. It would take quite a bit of work. But yeah, boundaries are huge. I always like to make it very clear of, you know, I'm a therapist, you're my client. Yeah, we're gonna get to some really intense, intimate conversations, but let's try to make sure that that distinction is clear, because sometimes I may have those little situations of, you know, getting a, you know, a Facebook request or something like that. Oh. And that can lead to some awkward conversation in the session the next week that I see you. And I'm going to be like, I probably would rather that didn't happen. So I try to make sure when I have my therapy sessions, everything's very upfront, you know, very, you know, I go at things very, very casual and just be like, hey, you know, this is maybe is not the best thing to do. Let's talk about it. And, you know, I try to make sure it's never from a confrontational, judgmental, punishing kind of stance, which is often what people get outside of therapy. So I make it a very clear decision not to come from that place.
Yeah, good job, Pariah. One more thing. I'm so sorry. I keep talking over.
Okay.
Your turn, Rebecca.
Okay. On the paperwork thing, I would say sometimes the paperwork is required by whatever organization the therapist works for, or it might be required by your insurance company. The therapist might have to fill out some stuff after the first session so that you can get your future sessions paid. Sometimes that's the case. In any case, a little bit of get to know you at the beginning is really important because you're paying for an individualized experience. And so the therapist needs to take time to really get to know you so that when we get into that stuff about helping you change later on, you can feel confident that the things that we are talking about are based on our understanding of you and not some generic one size fits all kind of solution that you could have got from reading a book. And I like to tell people that up front so that they have some understanding of like, yeah, the first session maybe isn't the most exciting, but it's really important so that I can appropriately help you later on. It really is for your benefit long term. And I think if you know that going into it, because I also am a therapy client, and I just sort of know that the first session is like, yep, we're going to go over some history and I'm going to ask some answer some questions and whatever. And when you know that that's part of the process, you might leave that first therapy session feeling hopeful rather than discouraged, or feeling neutral rather than discouraged.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I was going to say something similar about the paperwork piece being okay. Important and read it, you know, like read over your therapist's policies. They will probably go over them verbally with you the first session, but we know paperwork, it's not fun. Like, we don't do it to punish people. We do it to gather really important information that we definitely, we want to have it written down, and we want to have, sometimes it works to just as reminders to the therapist on what to actually go over verbally with you. So all that stuff you're writing down in the forms, you're probably going to go over with them during the session too. And it's all really important information. And like Rebecca said, sometimes it's required by law. But don't hesitate to ask. You know, you can always ask, like, why are you asking me this question? You know.
Yeah.
Eric, go ahead.
This is great. This is, I think these are exactly what the emailers have been wanting to know. You want to take the next one, Amaya?
Sure. Yeah. I was just wondering, how would a therapy with a child look like in opposed to with an adult? What sort of differences there are? What can a child or a teenager expect when they walk into therapy for the first time?
Okay, so depending on the age, it can definitely look incredibly different. Generally, the youngest I like to work with is about 8 years old. Once we pass that threshold, I start to be in territory I'm not entirely comfortable with. So a lot of times therapists do set certain age limits. Like, I've met some therapists that will work with preschool on. I've met other therapists that only go from like 13 on, you know, it really depends on your comfort levels, your expertise, things like that. With a very, very young child, therapy tends to be more play therapy, because generally you cannot get a very, very young child to sit with you for, let's say, 30 minutes at a time and start really talking about some deep topics and like really get some introspection. You know, some can, not all of them can. Some of them can do it in short burst. Some of them I found it's really beneficial to do it in a way that's non-threatening. So oftentimes we'll use toys, and Uno has become, you know, the best thing in the universe, because I'll be just playing a game with them and just kind of, oh, so how you feeling? What's going on with you? What's going on? And they're just playing. They don't even realize oftentimes that you're asking all these questions to get to know them better. Other therapists, they'll use drawing is a very common example, something you can do with a child, between drawing, painting, making a collage. Some of them even make like dioramas and make like full on little constructing, all these types of things. Sand play was very popular for a lot of offices. They had like the little, it was a kinetic sand. That's like this really trippy sand that's like weirdly thick. It's weird. It's awesome though. Kids love it. They love it. So we start just building things or Lego blocks and just start building things. And it just becomes like a lot of the times the children see me more as a friend than a doctor, which is an interesting place to be in, because then we start to build that trust and they can tell me things that maybe they can't tell their parents or they don't feel comfortable telling their parents. So teenagers are a whole nother ballgame because generally they don't want to play the game. Some of them do, but generally they don't want to play the games. With them, oftentimes we'll use music or TV and I'll relate with them through those, like, oh, what you watching lately? And then we'll just start talking about this. And oftentimes we'll relate it back to whatever's going on with them in their life. Sometimes we do encounter the barrier of, you know, they don't exactly really want to talk to me. And I have to find that way to kind of become that invitation to conversation. But it can be a challenge because more often than not, they are brought by a parent. So it's a little bit different when it's an adult coming in saying, oh, I want help with these things. Oftentimes, especially with the teenagers, they're brought by their mother, father, guardian, whoever it is, saying, I want you to help my child with this. And then it becomes this awkward situation of like, but is that what the child wants? And then I have to kind of figure out that way to balance both. When it comes to the actual session, depending on who you work with, sometimes the therapist will meet with the parent first individually to get like a view of what's happening. And then they'll meet with the parent with the child. Sometimes they'll meet with the child individually. And then it really depends on who you work with, the order that they do things. I generally like to do a little bit with the parent first, with the kid's permission. I'll go out to the front and be like, hey, if it's cool with you, can I talk to your parent for a little bit so we can do some boring paperwork? And they'll be like, yeah, take them. And I'll be like, we'll be right back. And then, you know, I talk with the parent to get, because I don't want to do this in front of my client, because sometimes they'll be discussing things that maybe they don't want to be, you know, discussed in front of the child right away. It can be kind of uncomfortable. It can create some awkwardness. It can just be a little too much too soon. Oftentimes I like to have the child themselves tell me certain things rather than it comes straight from the parent. It really depends on the situation. Each situation, as with all things in therapy, each situation is different. It's really hard to kind of generalize much of anything. But my initial session with anyone who's under 18, I go full blast into the legal issues of it, of if the parent comes and says, I want you to basically be a spy for me and tell me everything that my child tells you, we're gonna have a problem, because that's not what therapy is. Like, I'm here to support the child in whatever it is they need support. And only with their permission can I discuss certain things. And that can lead to some interesting legal issues, especially when it comes to, you know, what are minors legally permitted to do in each state. Like, you know, if a child comes to me with, let's say, a sexual concern, depending on what state we're in, I'm not legally obligated to share any information with their parent. So that can cause some definite issues, because if the parent comes to me, why didn't you tell me this? I have to explain to them legally, my hands are tied on certain things. I know generally in therapy, we have to make very clear where the lines are drawn regarding confidentiality. If the child comes to me and says that someone is hurting them or that they want to hurt someone else, that I need to share that information. I can't keep that to myself. That's if the child is in danger, and really that applies to any client, child or adult. If the client is in any sort of danger of bodily harm, any sort of abuse, that's automatically I have to break the rules of confidentiality. So I make that very clear when I work with my minors of like, if your mom or dad comes in here and asks me what you said, I can't tell them. But like, if you tell me that you're planning to hurt yourself or you're planning to do something or someone's hurting you, then I absolutely have to tell them. And they generally go, okay, I understand, which is an uncomfortable conversation to have, but it's necessary.
Yeah, I can imagine that a lot of parents feel like entitled to know what is going on And I mean to like every single detail of the therapy, not just overall what you're discussing or if there is actually something wrong that, you know, as you said, that it could be dangerous for themselves or for other people. So yeah, I can imagine so many parents going there like, just tell me what you're talking about. I want to know everything.
Mm-hmm. And oftentimes I'll just invite them into a session with their child. I'd be like, if you really, really want to know, then let's schedule a little three-way conversation or whatever way you want to do it. And sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't.
We got another, Rebecca, Casey, do you want to hop in on this anymore?
Yeah, I would say because our audience here tonight is all adults, I think. On the kid therapy thing, it's most likely that we're talking to parents who might be taking their kids to therapy or thinking mm-hmm. about taking their kids to therapy. And the other thing that I would add in there is expect that you will be getting homework as the parent. I know a lot of times when parents are frustrated and they bring their kids or teens to therapy, they want to be able to like pass them off to the therapist and say, fix them, and then give them back to me. And we know, I mean, I'm trained as a marriage and family therapist, and we think about things like the family as a whole, the whole like system, the unit. And we can't expect that kid to change all on their own. And for the therapy for your child to be really effective, you are probably going to need to do some things at home to support what's happening in the therapy too. So maybe that's, hey, the therapist has taught your kid these skills and we want you to know what they are so that you can practice them with your child at home. Or we're going to ask that you might change the rules at the house or the way that you do discipline or the way you talk to your child a little bit. Not because we think that you're wrong and a terrible parent, but just because we see this as a way that we can really support your child and get them where they need to be and live in a great life as soon as possible. So just like know to expect that. And then when it comes, you don't have to feel real upset about it. And I know when I've worked with, I don't work with very many kids, but I do work with teens sometimes. And when I've worked with them in the past, I love the parents. It makes it so much easier when the parents come and say, if I'm doing anything wrong, just tell me. Tell me how I can change. I really, like, they just care about their kids and love them so much, right? So if you go in with that attitude, knowing, teach me how I support my child, it'll be a much better experience for everyone.
Well, that's the ideal.
Right.
Like, I wish that was the situation every single time. Unfortunately, sometimes it isn't. And those, you know, that it does happen. But yeah, like, if we can work on this as a team of like everyone just on the same page working together to make sure that we reach that goal, it's amazing.
And things can take time to work through. I think especially with teenagers, I used to see a lot of teenagers in my practice and it can take a while for them to open up and trust the therapist. So, you know, if you're a parent of a teen or a kid who's involved in therapy, you know, give it some time. And don't lose hope right away and don't expect, you know, that your kid's going to walk out of their first session, you know, being a brand new person.
Right. As long as going back to the fit thing, as long as you trust and like the therapist and your child trusts and likes the therapist, then just.
Right. Rebecca, thank you.
Time. Apparently that's the soapbox that I'm on tonight.
That's a good one. That's a good one.
Okay, and moving to a completely different topic, we have received a specific email from RFRX to the email account. And the question is coming from someone who doesn't believe in God, but still has this urge to pray. So how can this person deal with this feeling that they need to pray?
Yeah, I actually read this question when it was posted in our prep before this meeting. And what I would say to this person about why you still feel the urge to pray when something goes out of hand is that the connection between those things in your brain is strong and is something that's been repeated. So we know there's a saying from people who study neuroscience that neurons that fire together wire together. So in the past, you've been trained to think bad things happen, I should pray. Those things are connected in your brain. And so now when bad things happen, your brain automatically thinks time to pray. That doesn't necessarily mean that you maintain a belief in God, or that this is like the Holy Spirit trying to speak to you or something like that. It could just be that in the past, those two concepts were so closely associated together that when one happens, the other one still comes up. And that's like totally fine. And the great thing to understand about how our brains work is that we can also form new neural pathways. So you get to decide, when hard things happen, what do I want to do now? What's the go-to? Likely, and we can look at that in terms of like, what did prayer bring to you in the past? Bad things happened and I prayed. What did that do for me? Did it help me feel calmer? Did it help me connect in with sources of support? Was it something that helped me feel like I was not alone? And you can find new ways to feel like you're not alone, to feel calm and grounded, that like new behaviors that serve the same purpose. And the more that you practice those new things, you're forging this new neural pathway so that further down in the future, that one is just as used as the old one. And then maybe even further down in the future, you hardly ever think about praying when things go wrong, because that's such an old thing and that association is really weak now. And I also think when things are really, really, really bad, if you feel the urge to pray and you like do it and it makes you feel better, all right. I think there's something that's like a, you know, very practical about that.
It's not going to kill you, is it?
Exactly. It's not going to kill you. If you don't believe that any of that is real anyway, and you go through some sort of ritual that calms you, all right. No shame.
Could it be substituted by things like meditation or like breathing exercises or
something like that? Absolutely. Absolutely. Those were actually the types of things I was thinking of when I said you might find new activities that help you feel that calming, grounded, connected feeling. Yeah.
Okay. That's great. And for someone who is underage and still living with their parents, how can they come out in a way to their parents in a way that is not harmful to them, as in them, the parents, or themselves, especially if, you know, these parents are Christians to the point that they go to church all the time, and they will probably think that their child will burn in hell, or, you know, they are sinners and all stuff like that. How can they come out to their parents in a safe way?
Okay. There are like four questions embedded in that one. And I think a whole lot of it depends. If the person is underage and is still living with the parents, let's just be really real that in some situations it might not be advisable and it might not be safe to come out. If this young person is going to be kicked out of the home and be homeless, they might decide to not say anything to their parents until they're at a place where they have a good support system, they have somewhere else to live, they could take care of all of those things on their own. And I think that that's totally okay. If the person feels reasonably confident that like, I could do this and there might be some blowback, but my parents aren't going to, you know, throw me out, then there's a whole bunch of different ways that it could go, but I think that general principle would be to focus on the relationship. That's my thing, right? That's what I do. Focus on the relationship. Tell your parents you love them so much. This information that I'm sharing with you doesn't mean that I reject you as parents. It doesn't mean that I think that you're terrible parents. I actually want our relationship to be better. And I feel distant when there's this big part of me that you don't know about. And so I'm sharing this with you because I hope that we can feel close, because I trust that you love me enough that we could still have a good relationship despite this big difference between us. Mm-hmm. I really like the phrase to, and I can't even claim it, I'll borrow it from another therapist, but that what we do in these situations is to turn up the volume on love. So to just really reinforce that I care about you, mom and dad. I love everything that you've done for me. I really want us to be have a good relationship. You might think that some of those things are like a given and that they shouldn't need to be said. But in these types of hard conversations, especially when you know that what's going to be activated for your parents is their fear for your immortal soul, you need to be extra reassuring that you love them. I might give different type of advice to a person who's older, but a person who's like a minor and still living in the home, I think it's a little bit too much to ask a teenager to have a ton of empathy for the parents and to help them through their own difficult time and whatever. Like if you are this person and you're listening to us, maybe you could send your parents to some of the resources on recovering from religion. I know that there are groups out there to help and support these parents, and I don't think that it should be on the kid to have to be the person who provides that support, but any of us in this group could help connect the parents with some supports to know how to still love their teen and to work through all of the grief and the difficulty that they're going through on their own with this new information.
Yeah, it would be too much responsibility, I guess, to put in someone who is just, you know, living with their parents and a minor, and especially your parents are always going to be a form of reference for you. So it wouldn't be fair for them to have to take care of the parents apart from their own selves, which is already hard enough.
Exactly. That's not your job.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Okay. And if someone is like a new atheist, what sort of challenges can they expect to face once they have become an atheist in terms of like societal like issues, like people thinking that they are going to burn in hell, or I don't know, not having any friends anymore, or what sort of challenges can they face and how can they overcome these challenges?
I could answer this one, but I feel like I've been talking a lot. Do either Casey want to jump in?
Yeah, when I read that question, I wasn't sure about what they meant by where does it go wrong? So I was thinking it must mean like in that experience of coming out as a non-believer, when do things get particularly difficult?
Not just socially, also like emotionally, like how can you deal with, I can imagine people struggle with fear of hell or a loss of purpose in life and things like that.
Yeah, I think that it really depends on your support system. And I think a group like RFR can be so helpful during that time. And if, you know, if your main support system in your life are, you know, mainly religious people, that can be really difficult. So it's important to find some support from people who get it and who are going through a similar thing. Seeking out a therapist through the Secular Therapy Network is an option. I had a note about a book. I'm sorry, I'm looking at my notes. I think books like Sam Harris has a lot of great ones. His book, The Moral Landscape, was really helpful for me when I was going through my, coming out as an atheist, because he explains how science, I was a big science person. I was a big rational thought person. Like I just, you know, that was my thing with religion. It never made sense to me. And the thing that was holding me to it was the moral question. Like, how can I be a moral person if I'm not, you know, a believer in God? And when I read his book, you know, he talks about how science can help us determine our values. And it was like a huge light bulb for me that values don't have to have anything to do with religion. So look for books by authors like that who get it and who can validate this experience for you. But really, I think support is so important. That's kind of all I had for that one. Rebecca?
I would say also, like, yes, you get your own support because it's gonna be hard. with the existing relationship. So make sure that you've got a good secular or atheist or humanist or whatever community that you can rely on. And then I think, like, be patient with your family and friends. You got to know that there are stereotypes, really negative ones, about atheists. And you come out and use that word and tell people that you're an atheist. And they might initially have all of these negative things come to mind about who you are. And so you may need to have a little bit of patience in, like, re-educating people or letting them get used to the fact that you're still just you. You just don't go to church anymore. I know I experienced this with, getting ahead of myself. Because the thing is, even the fact that we're talking about a coming out means that you likely have gone through this process on your own, and it's been a long process. Most people are, like, months or years into some kind of doubt or deconversion process by the time that you are thinking about talking to your friends and family about your change in belief. And it's really unfair for us to expect these people who have known us a particular way and in particular contexts to immediately be okay with that change, to accept and adjust to it, like, right now. It's just not reasonable. And so if we can be patient with them and allow them a little bit of time to adjust to the change, you might find that you still can have really great relationships and they still love and support you. I know one of my best friends from high school told me once that when I came out and was open about not believing in our church anymore, that she had, like, moved me mentally in from a category from, like, insider believer, one of us, into, like, outsider, one of them, because that's just kind of what she knew. And she said one time she was talking to me and she would, like, almost started to edit herself because she wouldn't say that to, like, a non-believer. And then she, and, like, bless her, right? She stopped. You love my religious language there, Eric. Like, she said she stopped herself and went, wait a minute, this is just Becca. I don't have to change. Like, I don't have to do any of that stuff. This is just my friend who's been my friend since we were 14. Oh yeah. Okay. But she had to, like, go through that process a little bit, and we're still really, really good friends. And you might have to do a little bit of work to just, like, let your family see that you are still a good person. You're still the sibling and daughter and son and spouse that they've always known and loved.
Yeah. And sometimes you might have to set limits with people, you know, if they are not these lovely people that Rebecca describes, if they're more like my family.
That's also true.
you know, if they're toxic to you and they refuse to even budge and they are those, like, all in your face kind of religious people, you know, set limits on how much time you spend with those people.
Yeah.
And Rebecca's going to do a really good talk coming up. When is that? July, on setting boundaries.
Yes. We're going to talk in depth about that. How do you set those boundaries? How do you respond when people say that they're praying to you or giving you religious gifts or whatever? Yeah.
Yeah. So please, like, you guys who emailed questions about family members and dealing with that, like, definitely tune in for that talk. It's going to be awesome. No pressure, Rebecca.
Yeah. Thanks.
We've got several more questions, but we're going to wrap up with one more. This one came from the chat. This woman was born in the 50s, and so the 50s taught her place as a woman, and also the church taught her place as a woman. And then her mother was basically, she says that her mother was basically raped by her father anytime that he wanted to have sex. So she feels like she was hit with, like, a triple play where it's all these negative things coming together, and it's really affected her sexuality. How can she get that back? And someone actually asked a very similar question along the lines of, how would I begin to explore my sexuality of being very experienced? So there's a very inexperienced. So there was a gaining sexuality from being traumatized, and then regaining sexuality from being inexperienced. What are some of the suggestions you guys got?
I believe they also, at least one of them, asked for book recommendations.
Yes, books.
Generally, when it comes to women's sexuality, one of the go-to books that everyone has recommended is Come As You Are, which is very highly recommended when it comes to just in general women's sexuality. There is another book that's also very recommended, but it's ginormous. So it's not everyone's cup of tea, which is, I have it over there, Our Bodies Ourselves. The thing is like this thick. So normally we start with Come As You Are, and then if you want to go like super mega in depth with it, you can probably get the next book, and then, you know, like it really goes very much in depth with that one. When it comes to a website that I sometimes recommend to people, Betty Dodson has a website. It's not for everyone. It does have a lot of illustrations of female anatomy. If not everybody's cup of tea, if you're cool with that and you want to just explore just that aspect, because I've had a lot of people that the part of their struggle is their body and kind of accepting their body. So if that's something that you're exploring, sometimes I recommend Betty Dodson's website and kind of take a look. It has a lot of writings on it. She even offers workshops on how to orgasm. You know, like she does a lot of work in this field. When it comes to trauma, it can be really intense. You can work with some therapists that are trauma focused. Not every trauma focused therapist is experienced with sexual trauma, so it can be a little tricky. Sometimes I like to recommend just going straight to finding a sex therapist, because some sex therapists will specialize in that particular area. So if that person is looking to really, really just kind of jump straight into discussing sexuality and maybe either embracing sexuality, or if, I don't know, I've had all sorts of issues when it comes to, for example, people that don't really know how to masturbate, or they don't know how to be in their body during the moment, or they want to learn how to experience pleasure more fully. So all these things can be addressed in sex therapy. Generally, I like to just give people the website of ASECT, which is where you would find directory of sex therapists. Generally, a sex therapist should be secular. I cannot imagine there being super religious sex therapists, but you never know. There might be somebody, I guess there should be some, but you know.
For a fact, there is at least one, because I saw it in a YouTube video that I came across, and it was terrifying.
Okay. All right. Well, all right. But generally, we don't use any sort of religion or spirituality when it comes to this stuff. It's talk therapy. Sex therapy is not hands-on. So if a lot of people are worrying that this is something where like a literal person is going to come in and try to like do things to you physically, do not worry. It's not about that. It is just regular talk therapy. However, we sometimes do assign homework. And the homework is for you to do certain things if you feel comfortable doing them at home. Or just reading. Some clients, they prefer to just do a lot of bibliotherapy. They read and we'll discuss during the session, all right, what did you learn? And what did you experience from this? And what are you going to maybe try? You know, sometimes they'll get ideas for things and we'll discuss it. And it's, for a lot of people, very valuable, because I always like to come back to this, of the fact that it's non-judgmental. Basically, I hear and see and all sorts of things, and you know, it's just kind of like a regular day for me. So for a lot of people that sexuality is such a tricky topic, it's beneficial to have someone that literally doesn't even blink an eye when you tell them about these things. Like, okay, cool, all right, what do you want to talk about? So when it comes to female sexuality, I feel like we have so much to discuss in that we may have to have like a full-on discussion about it, because generally I feel like it is male centered when people talk about sexuality, and the women tend to kind of get left behind, which is unfortunate, but maybe we'll do that soon.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. All of your input has been so amazing. We have covered so many topics. And we still have a couple of questions unanswered, but unfortunately we don't have more time today. I don't know about in the US, in the UK it's 2:30 a.m. in the morning. So, yeah. But I really enjoyed this talk. It's been really, really good. So thank you all so much. It's been really amazing.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.